Hi, and welcome back to the Glenn Show. Good to be talking to you, Anne.
It's good to talk to you.
Now, everyone is talking about the firing of executive editor Jill Abramson at the New York Times, and you've been writing about that. And I've heard quite a bit of angry commentary indeed on television. Many of those comments coming from women who speculate that she hadn't been treated fairly there or something of this sort. I'm wondering if are
Now,
you.
I don't watch the new shows on television. They
Oh.
take too long to absorb. So I haven't seen this display of anger by women journalists on television, but I guess I've read a little about that and heard of that. Some people are saying that Abramson won the PR battle, that the New York Times, I don't know, they sort of stay within their little website, their little operation there, and get their word out the way they do. But the larger PR battle, I guess some of which is on TV, which I avoid, but a lot of it is in print and on blogs and so forth. There are lots of female commentators writing, blogs and columns in various newspaper websites and so on. So there was a lot of outlet for getting the story out from her point of view that she was discriminated against as a female and so on.
Well,
But I missed the
wait a
part
minute
that was
now.
on TV,
Mika
so.
Brzezinski on Morning Joe had a panel one morning. Carly Fiorina and two other women of substantial accomplishment were a part of this panel, and they went around, I don't know, for 10 minutes speculating about whether a pushy woman, whether a woman who's too aggressive, whether a woman who wants to make an inquiry about is she being paid as much as a man who did her job was being paid, is a woman who's not employable at the New York Times. And there was more than a mild subtext there of they fired her because she's a woman.
Well, I mean, does the New York Times have a pay scale that has a male-female differential, that if there were some kind of litigation, or if the women massed together, not just Jill Abramson, but the rest of the women that are there, if they really did a study and compared what had been going on for decades, presumably, what kind of a pattern would they show? I mean, I think it's pretty funny that the New York Times, which tends to be pretty strong on women's issues and to present unequal pay as a something to criticize others about, if there's big hypocrisy here or even any hypocrisy here, that's quite a story. And now that Abrams is out and she's kind of on the loose and able to, gravitate commentary around her, that's very bad for the New York Times. A very interesting phenomenon. Who
Do
knows
I
what will happen
detect
there?
just a little bit of Schadenfreude in your comment here? Too bad for the New York Times. That seemed to be dripping with irony. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I think that there's often a lot of very harsh criticisms of what other people are doing, interpreting things to be unequal pay, gender-based pay. And there's a lot of talk about how, women make 77 cents on the dollar for males. And, on the conservative websites, well, you're the economist. So on the conservative websites, there's often discussion of there's actually some explanation for that. It's not really based on sex discrimination. But I've always associated the New York Times with the stronger argument that presumes that there is sex discrimination there, and that the people who are trying to weasel out of the charge really should have their feet held to the fire by the
Well,
New York Times.
I want to
So,
come to Abramson, but I first want to make a comment about the sex discrimination issue in general. Yes, I'm an economist. Everybody out there knows that. And I think this 70 cents on the dollar talk is infantile. Okay, I mean, I just think it's absurd, and it is demagoguery. I'm not saying that women are not in circumstances that could be identified being treated unfairly. Those cases are in the courts. They've been demonstrated on more than one occasion. I'm sure that it happens and it shouldn't happen, and there should be laws against it. Indeed, there are laws against it. But I think just taking the gross figures about what a man and a woman based on gender are making, and even if you narrowed it down to a particular firm or a particular institution like the White House. There's no reason to expect that those average numbers are going to come out the same because two different individuals working for a concern are not the same product and they shouldn't necessarily be getting the same pay. And there are reasons, and we could trot them out. I don't want to seem to be a defender of gender discrimination. I'm not. Why those numbers wouldn't necessarily be the same. And the same thing could be true if we were comparing blacks and whites, or if we were comparing foreign-born and native-born and so on. You can't prove discrimination by looking at those aggregate numbers. You have to get down to cases, and you have to control for the characteristics of the workers that are being valued in the labor market. So that aside, but now, it's obvious that the Democratic Party has elected to make, you know, the Republican war on women, one of those fronts is going to be, quote, pay equity, close quote. And the Lilly Ledbetter Act and all of that. And I'm for pay equity, and the Republicans on the other side of the aisle aren't for pay equity. But as I say, much of it, to my mind, comes to demagoguery.
So Democrats have made this their issue, pay equity, and there are certain talking points of that. But then there are these embarrassing discrepancies. You mentioned the White House, also the New York Times. Now, maybe they think, but for us, there's an explanation. There are all these multiple factors. And if you really looked at it in a fine-grained case-by-case way, you would see that what might on the surface look like discrimination really isn't discrimination. So they want to be able to say that. The New York Times is going to want to be able to say that. The White House wants to say that. But meanwhile, they've been using the cruder points against people who aren't on their side. So, I mean, I think it's a moment where maybe there's some hope that people will maybe climb down off the high horse and try to be more scientific and more evidence-based about it and more honest.
Now, you wrote a, you wrote a post, Anne, that said that the Times was calling Jill Abramson a bitch. I believe that's what your post said. Did I read it? Did I read it wrong? I mean, there's so many words. They weren't saying it out loud, but they were, you know, in effect.
How do you say right? How do you say something? Let's say you want to call her a bitch. How do you get that word out there? How do you say it? And I looked at the New York Times article, the main article that they had about the story. I guess it was the day the news came out, or the day after the news came out. It was a story called "Times Ousts Its Executive Editor, Elevating Second in Command." And of course, the New York Times has a certain all the news it's fit to print kind of a style where they present. I mean, I think they try to write in a lively way, but they, you know, they're sober, they're dignified in the way they present things. But so what I was kind of just taking that article, it's my style to have something, some text to work off. And I wasn't even going to tell you the truth. I wasn't even going to read that text because I thought they'll just cover everything up. They'll try to gloss over everything interesting. So that's boring. I'm going to read somewhere else. But my husband convinced me that it was actually really interesting. You should read that. So that I got up the next morning, I'm reading it all just like line by line and pulling it apart, you know, in a sort of a lawyerly way. Like I'm used to reading a lot of court cases that are written to make everything sound, you know, neutral and legalistic and not like there's any emotion or opinion infused into it. So finding what's between the lines is my thing. That as a blogging law professor, that's kind of what I do. So I was doing that with this article.
All right.
And I just arrived at the conclusion that they had found a way to call her a bitch. And the way they found to call her a bitch, just to sum up, you can read my whole article if you want, but
I did.
It is that as they tell the story of this, the man that replaced her, Dean, I don't know how to say his last name. Is it Baquet or is it Baquet?
I was saying Baquet, but I'm not sure.
Is it Baquet French?
Baquet is probably the French. I don't know. He's black. Okay. That much I do know.
Right. So, yeah, maybe. Oh, so there's a whole other issue I'd like to talk about, which is can you oust women if you replace them with a black person? So it's sort of like the Obama-Hillary. Well, we don't like to say no to the woman, but if we say no with a black person, that'll work out.
Oh, stop.
But that's a separate issue. That's the pattern. Oh, we can trump sex with ranks.
I don't understand why people can't just be hired or fired on the merits, and why it isn't to fire a woman if you don't want to hire her. I mean, what's the, you know, or black for that matter, but why?
Well, it's in the PR game, in the what are people going to think of us if we hire the first woman and then we throw her out and call her a bitch. How can we get away with that? They might think they can get away with it by saying, now we have the first black executive editor.
I see.
So, but that didn't work out for them. So, but on to, back to, we can proceed to that, but let me just get the bitch point out because I have to stop saying bitch repeatedly and I'll finally get to the end of this. But as they tell the story of Beckett or Becquet. I don't know if he uses the French pronunciation. I'll just guess.
Why don't we agree on a pronunciation? And even if it's wrong, we'll just be consistent.
I'm going to say Becquet.
Okay, I'm fine with that. Becquet.
That he got her place. There was some byplay between the two of them. He was the managing editor under her, and he was apparently quite enraged and went to Sulzberger, the owner over this, went to Sulzberger because she had, without consulting him, hired a woman from over at The Guardian to kind of co-manage, to share his position with him. So he's in a position, he finds this woman being installed along with him without his being consulted. That's very demeaning, insulting, just weird and threatening. It might be like, am I about to get fired? What's going on here? So he confronts Sulzberger over this. And then that leads to her being watched and things being said about her, basically presenting her as a difficult person or as someone that other people can't get along with. But along in the course of this article in the New York Times, they linked to something over there in Politico, written by Dylan Byers. And if you go over to what's in Politico, you can see that Becquet is quoted over there saying that other people, staffers, tend to think, he says, I think there's a really, you know, so he's explaining how other people on the Times staff feel demoralized or that she seems disengaged or uncaring. And this is a quote from Becquet that you have to go over to Politico to see. He said, and this was a year ago, but this is linked to in the New York Times' current article about the story. Becquet is quoted saying, I think there's a really easy caricature that some people have bought into of the bitchy woman character and the guy who's sort of calmer. That, I think, is a little bit of an unfair caricature. So you see how roundabout it is. The New York Times.
Well, only by your construction. Only because you're reading into it motives that are not apparent on the surface. You might have just been candidly saying, oh, it's really a very unfair caricature.
Well, but see how roundabout it is.
Both of me as calmer and of her as, what was the word again?
Right. And as him as being the guy who's sort of calmer. So he's not saying, even a year ago over in the Politico, he's not saying, she's a bitch and I'm calm. He's saying there are people who tend to think that that's an easy caricature and it's a bit unfair. Not completely unfair, a bit unfair. Okay, so I think that's all very interesting. That's over there in the Politico. That was said a year ago. But the New York Times, which doesn't usually link out, usually links to within itself. That's a kind of a game that you play within a website to get more hits. Your links go internally. This is an outward link, which they don't do that often. Links out to this article in Politico a year ago, and they had Becquet saying, bitchy woman.
Well, he's saying what some people say.
But he wasn't, right.
They're even saying that he's, they're saying with the suspicious link that he's saying that some people
right.
say.
Which is, that's, and so that's how the New York Times called her a bitch. That's how roundabout you have to be to do it. In other words, they didn't just come right out and say, executive editor fired because she's a bitch. They, you know, they framed it within all of this sober language. But if you dig down into it and follow all the threads, and I wasn't looking for trouble. I was just trying to read the article. If you dig down into it, you get to the point where she's called a bitch. And so
Or you get to a conspiracy theory in which she's hypothesized to have been indirectly called a bitch.
We could talk about things about race that are like that too. Everybody knows not to say racist things, apparently, except this one guy in California that owns the LA Clippers. Everybody else seems to know not to say racist things, but that means anything that people have to say is under a veneer or somewhere under the surface. If you're not going to look under the surface, you're never going to see anything again. So do you believe in taking things at face value?
Did you ever read the philosopher Leo Strauss? You know who I'm talking about?
I know who you're talking about, yes.
He's I'm sure he's no longer living, but he was an important figure in the middle, late 20th century. Straussian, you know.
Right.
And had created a whole school, had all these. So he has a book called Persecution and the Art of Writing, which is about reading, you know, medieval philosophers who might write between the lines because they couldn't directly say what their theories might have led them to say because the prince of the day would have had their heads chopped off.
Right.
So he says, this is a theory of reading. The theory of reading is you have to read between the lines. You have to take into account the character of the constraints, and you have to infer what the message might have been intended to be, not take it literally off the page, since people couldn't say directly what they think. And it seems to me that you're postulating a kind of persecution and the art of writing, but the persecution is the latter-day persecution of racial and gender, political and, I suppose, sexuality, homosexuality, political correctness, where people can't simply say what they think or know better than to say what they might be thinking. And therefore, we have to read them differently. We have to read carefully. We have to cross-check and back-check and all this kind of stuff. And it sounds crazy to me, but maybe
you're right. I don't think it sounds crazy. I think it's the most interesting thing about human life, that we do have some sense of what we should and shouldn't say. So we're holding back from saying things all the time. We're often repressing from ourselves, even admitting that we think things we feel that we shouldn't think. I mean, that's one of the most, I think that's kind of the most interesting things about people with language. We have our thoughts, which are in language. We have our speech. We see the reactions of others. We're trying to get along. We're also trying to do devious things, manipulate other people, maybe make other people feel intimidated by us without and still be able to deny it. I mean, that's the way life works. I mean, certainly I've been reading judicial opinions for more than 30 years, and I kind of make it my life's work. So in a judicial opinion, the judges have to make it seem as if they're working with the proper texts and methodologies. So if you're not, this stuff becomes unbelievably boring if you're not looking for what's really going on.
No problem.
What are the things that they know they're not supposed to
say? The only thing is that it leaves us in this world of speculation and second guessing and whatnot. And it seems to me it can also lead to damage because you can, you know, make false imputations about it.
True. But you can be damaged if you think, if you take everything at face value, you'd be very naive. But so what I do, and I think I know how to do this, being a lawyer too, is that you don't say anything you don't know. You speculate. You say, now I'm speculating, or it could be that, or one way to look at this, this could mean this, this could mean that. You just pull it apart and play with it. You don't make assertions of anything that you don't know. That's how you stay out of trouble. But, you know, that's hard to do too. That's why I feel like I can go into some places where other people can't. Or maybe I just get into a whole lot of trouble and I don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, I care a little. I don't care. I'm a little more protected from the risks than, let's say, a political actor.
Now, why should anybody care about who is the executive editor of the New York Times? I mean, people have been fired there before. I somehow remember Hal Raines being fired there because of some scandal about some guy who was making up stories that Raines had installed or protected or something. I'm not a journalism person, so I may be getting this wrong, but people are hired and fired all the time. Why should I care? Why should anybody care?
Remember when Dan Rather got fired? Remember how Dan Rather went?
But he reported on something on George W. Bush, did he not, that proved to be incorrect? I can't remember exactly the details of it now.
Rather, you don't remember Rathergate? Well, I think that there was a fake document.
I slept through Rathergate. Can you want to fill us in, or is it relevant?
Well, I think there was a document that was shown on 60 Minutes that indicated that George Bush had not shown up for his military obligations at some point. And it was proved to be a fake document, and Rather defended it, and even made an argument that's been paraphrased as fake but accurate. In other words, this isn't the real document, but we have reason to believe that this is what would be in the document if we had the document. But we were presenting the document as if it were the document. I think when people who are taken to be credible, like 60 Minutes, Dan Rather. You know,
but these cases are they're nothing similar at all.
You don't think that the New York Times is considered authoritative or a
No, I don't think
source?
That the firing of Joe Abramson is in any way related to malfeasance of the kind that might have gotten Dan Rather in trouble.
Right.
At least I haven't heard evidence to that effect.
Right. I don't think it. I
thought it was management style. And
it's presented as management
style,
and it's also presented as that she discovered that she'd been underpaid in relation to males who were either in or below her position. That as a managing editor, she was paid less than another editor who was in a lower position. You know, it's really enraging to find that out. You're working in a place and then you find out that someone who has a lower position than you is paid significantly more than you, and this has been going on.
Is that a fact? I didn't see that fact. I thought the Times had denied
in the outrage.
I thought they said she was paid comparable to what Bill Keller, the previous executive editor, had been paid. And so I don't know the facts, and I think it would be important.
Well, look at Ken Auletta at The New Yorker is kind of the one with the best information on this right now. And The New York Times is kind of trying to weasel around the information as it comes out. But I think it's so we'll see what happens with that. I know that they were demanding that Auletta make a correction over something where he said that he had quoted a New York Times source as conceding that something was a factor in her firing, and then they wanted it corrected that they had conceded that something was a factor, but not in her firing. It was a factor in something. So there's some fussy stuff going on, but obviously there's a problem, and it's, you know, it's a wound that's being picked at, and it could be a much bigger wound inside the New York Times. Well, you have a newspaper that's so respected for, although obviously also criticized on the other side, but I mean, to me, it's the newspaper I've been reading for since the 1960s. I've just read it. I rely on it. It has its problems, but what's better than that? I want it to work, and so I stay on its case. I think it's important. And you know, if they kick out one editor and put another one in, another thing I wanted to say about the firing of the woman is that I've been thinking in recent years. And I'm an older woman myself. I'm a woman approximately Abramson's age. I've been thinking, reading the New York Times, that it seems to be aimed at the older woman, specifically older white woman or older New York area woman. Many of the stories are aimed at that kind of mentality, that kind of taste. And so I think maybe especially the people that read the print edition, and they're obviously in this transition from print to digital. But I think in insulting the woman, in throwing out the woman, I think they're hitting at the core of their readers, which I think are older women.
Well, I read the New York Times daily. I read the print edition. I have it delivered to my home. I'm not an older woman. I don't know. I didn't notice this. Maybe I'm not reading every story in the newspaper and therefore not seeing the ones that are most geared to this demographic.
Yeah, yeah.
But
that's my hypothesis from reading it for a long time. If you look at the human interest story, the things that are in the magazines, the issues that aren't really big news issues. I mean, if the Ukraine is being invaded by Russia, that's going to be in the newspaper. But we don't have to hear stories about some other things that are more human interest stories here and there in different geographic locations. Why is that story brought out? I mean, I haven't done a scientific study of it, but that's my impression. I have the impression that their readers, that the people, that their kind of ideal reader who they're picturing and appealing to, at least for the print edition, is an older woman. I sort of feel like there was, at least in recent years, and maybe Abramson was responsible for this, that there was an appeal to women, just like the Democratic Party has its appeal to women. This is our constituency, the women. Don't have a war on women.
Okay, well, I don't think I can add anything on that. Race and gender. Now, I somehow recall Jill Abramson as having been made famous by the reporting that she did back during the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill controversy, sexual harassment accusations for The New Yorker. Do I get that right? Or was it The Wall Street Journal? Maybe there was a piece in The New Yorker.
She wrote a book.
There was a book.
She wrote a book, and it was co-authored with, I think,
Jane Mayer.
Co-author, who Jane Mayer was, I think that she was with The New Yorker. The book was called Strange Justice.
Strange Justice,
Clarence
indeed.
Thomas. And that came out in 1994, so exactly 20 years ago. Thomas's hearings were in 1992. I'm sure you remember that well.
I remember it very well indeed.
I want to hear your story.
I thought it was 91, as a matter of fact. I'm pretty sure those hearings were in 1991.
He went on the court in 92, so he's, yeah.
There was a confirmation process. I could be wrong, but I somehow remember 91. In any case, it's...
around that. But the book came out a couple of years later. So obviously 1994, Clinton was already president. A lot had already been written about it. But this was a very detailed book that did a lot of interviews. And people took it pretty seriously that things had been learned that corroborated the story. Like one person was quoted as having gone to Thomas's apartment. Maybe you can corroborate this. gone, haven't gone to Thomas's apartment and been shocked to see that his, this is from Nina Totenberg's contemporaneous review of the book. One woman, a civil servant who worked in the Reagan White House and who was friends with both Thomas and Hill, describes her shock when she walked into Thomas's apartment and found the walls covered with pictures of naked women.
Well,
that was used as
maybe I can corroborate this. Well, what I can tell you is this: I did know Clarence Thomas.
I know. So
during the 1980s and the early 1990s, yeah. And when he was at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission as mm-hmm. a commissioner, chairman of that commission, he did invite me to his apartment. I don't think it would have been the same one he was living in 1991 or whatever. But in any case, there. I noticed no such aberration.
Wait. What are you saying?
I'm saying that in the 1980s, and mm-hmm. let me see, I could try to guess, it might have been 85, it might have been 86. Mm-hmm. I was mm-hmm. in, maybe it was 84, I was in Clarence Thomas's apartment in mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. He was chairman of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
Right.
And it may not have been the same apartment that this person that you cited said they mm-hmm. entered to find walls covered with girly pictures.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw no such aberration when I entered Justice Thomas's apartment. You know, it's almost 30 years ago. But the whole thing
that was in Jill Abramson's book.
Come on. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Well, see, one thing I noticed here, and I'm looking at not Strange Justice, which wasn't on Kindle, so I wasn't able to get it into a search, but in Nina Totenberg's 1994 review of the book, that's what I was just reading from, one woman, Kay Savage, a civil servant, describes her shock when she walked into Thomas's apartment and found the walls covered with pictures of naked women. And now what I thought about that was, you know, if you're really against Clarence Thomas and you use the expression naked women, you didn't say pornographic. And what are we supposed to picture, that he just pulled out centerfolds from porn magazines and put them up? What was that? Or was it, I mean, pictures of naked women, the art museums are full of pictures of naked women. Pictures of naked women is not pornography.
That's
first
also
of all.
True.
But second of all, if you're trying to say that the charges made against Clarence Thomas are corroborated, are more likely to be true because he had pictures of naked women on the wall in his apartment and some woman who happened to go there was shocked to see them. Well, what did she see? What kind of pictures are we talking about? How does that corroborate the story that he would sexually harass someone in the workplace? I mean,
it's character assassination by some kind of innuendo, I guess. I mean, it means he's
it's just something
sex-obsessed guy who could therefore more plausibly be imagined to have harassed Anita Hill. I assume that's the argument.
Well, there was an effort a few years ago to do a study of the effect of pornography on men, on consumers of pornography, and they had to call off the study because they couldn't get a group of men who didn't consume pornography.
Yeah, I remember hearing that.
So apparently all men, or almost all men, look at pornography. The fact that a man looks at pornography doesn't really make him more likely to be anything, in my opinion, because it's just such a common practice. What does that say about how you would behave in the workplace? And there's something weird about collecting all of this meticulous information about someone and saying, oh, here is this elaborately researched book, and it's full of facts, and we did 100 interviews of people who knew him. But what are these facts? It could be 100 trash facts, facts that don't mean anything. You know, I never even understood what the Coke can story was supposed to prove anyway. But if the question is, did he make the remark about the pubic hair on the Coke can? Why did that mean anything? But why would the fact that he had pictures of naked women on his wall in his apartment make it more likely that he said that?
Well,
and what does it even mean? What
the
were
lines
these
too? I mean, we were talking about this in a different context earlier. It's a kind of saying he's the kind of person about whom it's more plausible to mm-hmm. believe some behaviors would be associated. He's that type mm-hmm. of person, and it's mm-hmm. very indirect, and it's, you know, it's kind of ugly. You know, mm-hmm. now that we're talking about this, I recall Juan Williams, another one of these guys that got fired.
Right.
Juan from NPR, black guy, because mm-hmm. of something that he said.
I remember what it was.
What was it?
He said that when he was boarding an airplane and he saw
that he had reason to be afraid
people,
if he saw Muslims sitting
he
in
got
the front.
A little scared.
Yeah, he gave a second thought. He couldn't help it. He just did. And he's being honest about that. But at the time of the Clarence Thomas hearings, he wrote this amazing piece I remember reading. And I'm, for full disclosure, people, I was a supporter of Clarence Thomas. I was a friend of Clarence Thomas. I was once a, you know, Reagan conservative. Okay, so go and do what you're going to do with that. We're going back 25, 30 years.
You can't hide that. I mean, you know, it's all on the internet.
Yeah. Okay, so I can't hide from that. But what I'm saying about Juan Williams is he wrote this piece in 1991 during the height of the controversy, and in which he sitting in, he was at the Washington Post and was privy to a lot because he was apparently doing a big piece. Maybe it was even a book about Thomas. He was doing some big investigative journalistic piece and therefore had done a lot of reporting and so presumably had a lot of dirt. Okay. And people were calling him up from the advocacy organizations that were going to stop Thomas no matter what at the confirmation hearings, asking him what the dirt was that he had. And didn't he know this and didn't he know that? And he wrote this piece in which he basically denounced all of this. He said, I'm getting calls from people. I'm getting notes from people. People are cornering me and they want to know and they want to know. And he says, it's absurd. It's ridiculous. And it's wrong. And he denounced it. He reported there that people were even going around looking in Thomas's trash can for receipts from the video rental place to try to find out what kind of porn videos he might be renting and whatnot. And he said, this is horrible and it's wrong. And, you know, I think that was the beginning of the end of Juan Williams' good standing in, you know, the sort of liberal journalistic circles, culminating in him getting pushed out at NPR.
He has a lot of stories too. I think there was an intimidation of especially of any black person that was going to say anything good about him. You probably experienced that.
There was so much intimidation I was getting for so many other outrageous things that I was saying that I didn't notice the incremental intimidation associated with defending. I did write a piece in the Boston Globe called I Believe Judge Thomas, right at the height of the controversy. And I got some hate mail about that. That's true.
I can't imagine what that was like. I mean, I watched it all from a distance, but, you know, I knew some people who were involved in some of that. And I just feel that, the story of trying to be, everybody should be able to say what they think. And it's hard to be a female and to say anything that's perceived as conservative. Oh, you're the conservative blogger. You know,
well,
it's sort of like,
this. So women, I think, are susceptible to being slammed for stuff that men do routinely, and people maybe even take it to be a virtue in men. This was one of the points in the Mika Brzezinski panel.
Right. Yeah.
If women are tough, if they're abrupt, if they're bottom line oriented, if they're hard headed and hard nosed, perfunctory, and you know, let's just get to it, whatever. Then that's a negative. Whereas if a man is doing that, you know, he's a go-getter. He's a guy that knows how to get things done. He's, you know, whatever, focused on the bottom line. So I think there's also something like that with respect to race. I mean, black guys, I think, are susceptible to being more readily typed as, I don't know what, sexually predatory or, you know.
Or also angry.
Exactly. Right. Angry and volatile and prone to violence and things of this kind.
Right.
And, you know. Sometimes it really is a very unpleasant thing to be so regarded. I can quote that firsthand.
I thought it was very interesting in this case of Dean Beck Kay, the new executive editor at the New York Times, that he was perceived as being affable and friendly. And whereas the woman, it has this brusque, bossy, bitchy quality. And, you know, what is it that makes people develop those qualities if, in fact, those are true qualities? It might be that a black person develops a style of being especially friendly to fend off stereotypical thinking in others and then gets to be thought of as being, you know, develops a friendly manner, whereas a female that develops a friendly manner just doesn't advance, is considered weak and too feminine. Everybody likes her, but she doesn't get the job. So you have to kind of cross those lines and be somewhat unfeminine and more sharp and hard-edged to get to the leadership position. And then they like to advance you because they want to show off that they have a woman. But then when you get there, you're not the kind of woman they really like. But the kind of woman they really like, they wouldn't have advanced anyway. So there's no way you can win. Anyway, I think I think there's some similar things about race and sex, but I think that some of them play out in different ways. How do you act to relate to people who might be or might be thinking something about you or not, and then how does that affect you, the whole trajectory of your career? I think that the issue with female leadership is that to be the female that got to the head of the line, as opposed to all the many other females who didn't get advanced, you had to go against the norm of being female. And you made a lot of sacrifices for that along the way. And maybe you got some attitude along with that. And maybe some of that attitude got you to the top. But then when anything started to go wrong and when people started to turn against you or had their own ambitions and counter to yours, now they don't like you. You're the bitch. But if you weren't the bitch, you would have never been anywhere near that position.
Yeah.
So that's what feels so unfair, I think, to females, if I may speak for females.
That sounds all very plausible to me. We're getting ready to have a female president of the United States with, I don't know, probability 0.3, 0.4. I don't know. She's got, you know, some probability of being.
What
Do
about
you think
her brain
that will change the conversation? I mean, this thing that you were just talking about, for example, I mean, leader of the free world, commander in chief of the largest military in the history of humanity, a person that has to send people into combat to die, that has to make life and death decisions on a daily basis, that gets the daily presidential briefing and has the general sitting at attention in the Situation Room. Doesn't that like change the game, perhaps in a way qualitatively different from the way that having a brown or a black face in the room would change the race game?
Well, how do you think having a black president has changed?
I don't think it's changed it that much. That's, you know, kind of the point that I'm trying to make in drawing this contrast. I don't think it's changed it that nearly so. I mean, I'm not saying it's had no effect. I think it hasn't had. And I think the ability of Barack and Michelle Obama to make public, you know, events and statements with the imprimatur of the, you know, head of state and head of government of the United States of America is not nothing. It's really something beyond our shores as well as domestically. But whether or not it has had an impact on the micro dynamics of race relations and so forth, I have my doubts. I mean, you know, if you're a young black man with a hooded sweatshirt walking in, you know, you're pants down around your waist and whatnot, you're still going to be viewed with suspicion. Nobody's going to say, oh, but that could be Barack 30 years from now.
And some people are going to say, you always have one individual and he belongs to one party. And then when people want to criticize him, the party that wants to defend him is always in a position to insinuate or directly say, you're saying that because he's black.
Well, that has been a Democratic mantra. There may be some truth to it. He wouldn't be getting this resistance if he weren't black. I mean, the Attorney General made that statement not long ago, you know, that he wouldn't have been treated with such disrespect at a congressional hearing if he hadn't been black. It's I can just report as a black that temptation is almost irresistible sometimes.
Right.
And it can be quite debilitating. I mean, sometimes it's true, but most of the time it's probably not true.
Well, back to reading between the lines.
Yeah,
obviously, that is the reading. And so people might want to say, well, they're criticizing him because he's president, he's exercising power, and they genuinely disagree with him. How dare you say that that's because of race? You're pandering. And,
on the other hand, I think having to swallow a policy that you disagree with when it has been promoted and implemented by somebody who looks like him may make it all that much harder, you know, more painful to have to swallow. It could be that you didn't like the policy, and now you like it even less in virtue of the fact that it's, you know, it has a black face on it.
And you can't really disaggregate those things.
It's
you might
hard.
Say, well, I think almost the vast majority of Americans like to think of themselves as not being racially prejudiced at all. But you can you ever even be honest with yourself? Can you, even if you tried to be honest with yourself, could you disentangle the part of your objection to Obamacare that's because of the policy itself, and what part of it is because he's black, and what part of support for it is because people want to see the first black president be a successful president? There's no way to pull all of that apart, really. So, but then the question is, how does the dynamic change once the first has come and played an important role? How does that change things going forward? And now that we've seen what it's like to have the first black president, should we be eager to get the benefit of the first female president, or should we be a little careful about doing that again?
Well,
I mean, are the benefits really so great to crank through that first? When we're talking about giving the person the greatest power on the face of
the world. Well, this is not the only reason that we would be giving it. to Hillary Clinton if she would have ascended to the presidency, or not the only reason that Barack Obama was elected, that it would have some beneficial effect on race relations, atmospheric effect, or whatever. But my belief, for what it's worth, is that the gender narrative shift, the sort of dislodging of the subtext of presumption and stigma, that effect would be much bigger than the race effect. That the Hillary Clinton, I mean, half the population are women. Women are, on the whole, please don't get mad at me, people, for saying this, not a disadvantaged group. Okay. They are the mothers, sisters, and daughters of men who have intimate connections with them across the board. Where it seems to me, you know, almost a half century into a real transformation of consciousness around gender relations that has changed everything. Sex and love and marriage and courtship and family and work and child rearing and everything else. And this could kind of be a capstone. I mean, this could be, you know, like locking into place something very definitive about gender equality in American society in a way that just wasn't feasible for anybody. This is not a shortcoming of Barack Obama to do with respect to race. Blacks remain a severely disadvantaged population, overrepresented amongst, you know, lawbreakers and school failures and et cetera, et cetera, crowded in the ghetto districts in the big cities in large numbers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the deep consciousness of race discrimination hasn't been expurgated to nearly the extent that discrimination thing has been shaken. That's not gone, but it's been deeply shaken. So anyway, that would be my analysis.
Well, but that's a reason not to want the first female president.
Oh, we don't need her.
Well, and also, I don't believe anything's ever going to get locked into place. And but also, is she the right standard bearer for this? Is she the right exemplar?
That's another question.
Because what bugs me the most is that there are term limits on presidents. Bill Clinton served out 2 terms. He had his bill. He shouldn't go back into the White House. I feel like it's a loophole to term limits. I don't think it's right for a former president who served 2 terms to go back into the White House. And also, I think the first female president should have made it more on her own, not through a very politically talented man who has, by the way, already served 2 terms in the White House.
Okay, Anne, I've got an idea. I am hoping and praying that Hillary runs so that you and I can have a couple of conversations about exactly this.
Okay.
Why don't we call this one a day? I've got to get on to the next thing. But I really appreciate being able to talk with you and, you know, wish you well.
Okay.
Okay.
You too.
Take care.
Okay. Bye. Bye-bye.